view of the governor's proposed budget for Health and Human Services. There's a pretty large packet of material for members and for the public. When the commissioner's done, I think we're going to ask council to step us through how to navigate all of these documents and find different pieces in the various documents as we step through. And then from there, we'll go in and dig much deeper into every budget item, beginning with Assistant Commissioner Scott Leitz, reviewing the health care proposals, and Assistant Commissioner Lauren Coleman with the continuing care proposals. So with that, and I will say I have had a couple of, I realize we don't have a quorum just yet, but I have heard from a couple of members who are stuck in traffic. Really do appreciate their letting me know that they're going to be a little bit late. Senator Benson and Senator Rosen will be coming, and I believe we'll have a full house. These are, I always find, incredibly helpful as we approach the difficult job of crafting the HHS budget. So with that, we'll invite Commissioner Jessen to the table and go from there. Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Lucinda Jessen, Commissioner of the Department of Human Services. And thank you for giving me the opportunity to say, you know, to explain kind of in a very high level kind of the governor's proposed budget for the Human Services Department. And I apologize if I'm hard to understand. I'm having a cold, so let me know if I'm not being clear. But also may explain why my remarks may be briefer than usual, just because I'm not sure my voice will last. You have a PowerPoint before you, and I'll somewhat work from that just as a framework. I think we first start out just talking about our mission, because we really do always start to try and start from that place of how we're helping people, vulnerable citizens of Minnesota, and those who really do need a hand up. And then talking about the children, the seniors, the people with disabilities, who are at the focus of so many of our programs. And I think that will be reflected in our budget proposals that we're going to go through. Let me see if I can just set a context for you at a high level, picking up on where really George Hoffman, who spoke to you all recently and talked about the November forecast and where he left off, as George explained where we were in the November forecast. I think that's and the growth in the human services budget really is virtually all driven, you know, this from this forecast by the growth in services and enrollment for our seniors and people with disabilities. So that's going to be what when I talk about kind of numbers going forward, it's really building from the November forecast. And if you, I'm sure you all have heard a lot in the last 24 hours about the governor's proposed budget, you know, and I'm not going to dwell on the rest of, on all of that, but I would say overall from the November forecast, there is $38 million additional dollars for the Department of Human Services in that proposed budget. But when you look through the materials before you and when you hear about our proposed budget from, you know, the assistant commissioners in more detail, you'll hear a lot more than, oh, wow, here are $38 million in additional programming for one area or another. What we really did at the department, and we involved a lot of stakeholders and got a lot of really good input from them as well, is really looked at our whole budget and thought, how should we reprioritize what we're doing? So this is not just status quo plus, you know, a few additional programs. This is really an entire look at our budget. So, and when we did that, and if you look through, you will see over $200 million dollars of investments outside of the Affordable Care Act. And I think the easiest way to think our budget, of our budget as a overall this year with the changes from the Affordable Care Act is, well, think about the Affordable Care Act changes, which are really self-contained. And overall budget neutral. And then separately think about the rest of the department's budget. So we'll talk, and Scott Leitz will talk in more detail about the Affordable Care Act changes, but I'm saying once you get outside of the Affordable Care Act changes, you will see in additional about $200 million in what we would say new targeted investments. And those are funded by the $38 million of new spending, but also more significantly by about really reprioritizations of about $175 million in our existing budget. So you'll see a series of some things that are cuts, some things that are reallocations, because we are really trying to move money to the areas that we think are the real priorities for the department and for the state of Minnesota in the coming years. So that's kind of the overall frame I wanted to set. In this, let me just say, make a couple of comments first about the Affordable Care Act, because there are some unknowns, as we all know, in this part of the budget. As I said, the Affordable Care Act, part of the budget, you know, if you look at it as a whole, it is budget neutral. There's savings from the Medicaid expansion, which is proposed in the governor's budget, but there's also costs that are associated with the Affordable Care Act. You know, new people who are eligible for Medicaid today but who aren't on Medicaid that we have to that will be on Medicaid and that we have to pay our 50% state share on. There's significant costs in those areas. We also, in the governor's budget, set aside $117 million kind of from the savings in the Medicaid expansion to go towards kind of a new streamlined Minnesota care going forward. We also left kind of really on the bottom line of the Health Care Access Fund an additional $200 million. You know, as Assistant Commissioner Scott Leitz will describe in more detail, how much of that we need to use really depends upon our negotiations with the federal government. As I think I've said to all of you recently, we are asking may be a polite word. From CMS would say we're doing more than asking. We're being pretty demanding about the fact that we believe they should be giving us that basic health care funding, that 95% of the value of what they would pay in the exchange to us to help us continue to run Minnesota care. If we get that funding, then we'll need a lot less of the money we've set aside, you know, of that $200 million, you know, and if you look at it collectively, about $300 million. So, but on the other hand, just given the unknowns, we thought having some money set aside for that, some of which we really hopefully will not need to use at all, was prudent, given the uncertainties of those discussions. And as I think I've said to many of you, and I'm happy to answer more questions about this, you know, at any time, obviously, Mr. Chair, have been very clear with the federal government that we need an answer by the end of February about the level of federal participation in Minnesota care, because we need that before so that when the new forecast comes out, that then we can make informed, much more specific decisions that the legislature and the governor can make around Minnesota care. So we are really pushing on that. I just talked to the governor about this, the status of those discussions on Monday. He and I will be going out to D.C. together. He will be personally meeting getting that set up now with Secretary Sebelius, because we really want to raise the pressure on those discussions, because we need answers from the federal government quickly, and we know the answers we think they should give us. So let me just, with that, turn to the next page, which says budget highlights. And so I think this is kind of talking about when we're doing that reprioritization in our budget, where we saw the needs. We did, as I said, set aside this money, not sure just how much we'll need of it for Minnesota care, but we also really reprioritized a lot to build on our past accomplishments, but really to deal with what we see were more pressing needs in the human services budget. So if you look at the key initiatives page, you'll see what we thought were the big issues for us this session. You know, certainly we have to implement the Affordable Care Act. You know, as a result of that, we will have 145,000 Minnesotans who are not on public programs today, but most of them are eligible for public programs, on our public programs. So that is a substantial increase that is a result of our implementation of the Affordable Care Act. And that 145,000 includes those people who are part of the Medicaid expansion, but it goes far beyond that. It really includes a lot of people who are eligible for Medicaid today but just aren't on it. And reason we think we'll get a lot more of those people on it is we're streamlining the system. We're making eligibility enrollment easier, faster, more efficient. And there's also the effect of the mandate. We believe that more people will sign up. And we know that one of the big challenges in our state with people who don't have insurance, we know that the people who lack insurance in Minnesota today, that 9.1%, 60% of them are already eligible for one of our public programs. And these are really things that will enroll a lot of them. But as we said, there are costs associated that offset some of the savings that we get from the Medicaid expansion. Reform 2020, Assistant Commissioner Coleman will talk more about that. This to us is just a very significant initiative. You know, this, as so many of you all know, the fastest growing part of our budget and the part that concerns me the most looking forward with the age wave and the demographic changes is a growth in our services, especially our long-term care side that serve our seniors and people with disabilities. We need to, and this is a set of packages. We're negotiating waivers with the federal government, but this really is a redesign of our home and community-based services, one that's not aimed at taking away things from people, but enables us to offer a broader array of services to keep people in their homes and communities, which is where they want to be and overall is cheaper for the state, where we intervene earlier. So we reach out and catch people earlier before they need some of kind of the deep-end, more expensive services. It also includes a great deal to be more consumer-driven, where we put more power in the hands of consumers to make choices about what providers and what services they want. And we think giving more power to consumers and their families will be of real benefit, you know, to them and ultimately to the state's bottom line as well, and you'll hear more about that. That is something that saves about $150 million over the next 5 years. Our proposal is to reinvest that, but by the reinvesting it and moving and really redesigning our program, designing a program that by 2020 is much more sustainable than it is today. Because if we don't make those changes, start down that road of making those changes, we really will be in a difficult situation to continue the important programs we have for seniors and people with disabilities. I realize that I was looking for one page and not going through these. So I think I've talked a bit about the Affordable Care Act and about our Minnesota Care program, wanting to continue that program but really build on it. You know, we need to continue and improve it. There is so much streamlining that we can do in Minnesota Care, and that is part of our agenda for the next few years. There's a lot of overlap between our Medicaid and our Minnesota Care program, too much duplication. We think we can take out a lot of those duplicative administrative expenses. We can reduce the churn for people that kind of go between our two programs. We have families, one on one program, one on another, one set of providers for kids, another set of providers for parents. We really want to move towards a unified, more streamlined public program that deals with the churn and reduces our administrative costs. So we see as, you know, getting this federal funding for Minnesota Care today is really a way to start down that path. And as I said, with the Affordable Care Act changes and streamlining our eligibility enrollment, providing health care coverage to 145,000 more Minnesotans within our existing resources. I'll skip now, since I think I've already said a few words about Reform 2020, to the part of our budget that you'll see that really places an emphasis on children. You know, this a major part of where we're trying to reprioritize resources within the Minnesota, within the budget, and where we needed a few additional resources was really to better protect children and to get them off to a good start. And a lot of this is about making sure that we invest more in our in quality child care for children on our public assistance programs. Some of this is our increases to child care providers that haven't gotten an increase since 2006. But when you think about it, it's not paying providers, but parents, you know, usually those young moms on our programs who need the child care to either finish high school or to be in productive jobs in the workforce, with the limited amount we pay in child care assistance, they're having to make up that difference in out-of-pockets. We need to, I think, really make sure that we get the children into quality child care, and that's a better way to get at making sure those, and it's mostly mothers are graduating from high school and are getting into the workforce. We really, and there are a number of things in this budget that is really targeting the intergenerational poverty problem that we have on some of our programs. I think one of the most, and I know some of you all have heard me say this before, but one of the most troubling statistics I've heard as commissioner is that for mothers on our infant program and our assistance program, the teenage mothers, 75% of those teenage mothers, their mothers, were on assistance. So there are a lot of child care initiatives, home visiting initiatives, and other things that we're doing in this budget to really try and do all that we can to target those teenage mothers and their children to try and break that cycle of intergenerational poverty. I don't think any of us want to be thinking 20 years from now that that 75% number still exists. Our children's budget also does quite a few things to try and get more children who are in foster care today, especially those sibling groups, those teenagers, into permanent homes. Right now, because we know that we have 355 children waiting for permanent homes. And while we've made real strides in the last several years to reduce that number, that's too many. And the financial incentives now are skewed. The financial incentives are to do foster care. And we have foster care parents who want to adopt, but they do better to being foster care parents. And, you know, while we have so many good foster care parents in this state, children need to be in permanent homes. So we have really taken three programs, made it into one program. We've aligned financial incentives for children over six. We don't have problems getting the young children adopted, but we do on the others. So there's money in this budget to try and address that. I mean, when someone asked me a few days ago, what do you want to make sure happens at the end of your 4 years as commissioner? And one of the things is I want fewer children waiting for permanent families. We are doubling the access in the governor's proposed budget to school-based mental health services, which we think is a really great way, both on the mental health and the substance abuse side, really, frankly, to reach out to kids where they are in their schools, to cite problems earlier, to get them the help they need. I've toured some of these programs. They're very successful, evidence-based. We think this is just we are very excited to be able to propose doubling this. And we also want to focus those resources when we choose, okay, which of the school districts we're going to particularly look at those districts with the greatest disparities, because we see this as a tool to really tackle some of the health disparities we have in the state. And we also propose to expand our parent support outreach program. This is, once again, an evidence-based program that's in some of our counties today. And what it does is it looks at families that come into that where there are reports of child abuse, of child neglect. And we know that where those are substantiated, those children go into our child protection system. But we know that there are close cases where those families are so-called screened out. They said, well, this doesn't meet that level, but we know there are problems with these families. And so where we've been able to identify those families and really do this parent support outreach where we wrap more supports around those families, the evidence shows us that those children are far less likely to later end up in our child welfare system. So this is, once again, kind of expanding what an evidence-based program that helps children. Turning to the next slide, I mean, some of what we're talking about is children really overlap with our next slide because a lot of these deal with the behavioral health continuum. But there's some additional ones that aren't just focused on children here as well. And this is really our effort to look at our mental health system and some our chemical dependency system and say, where are there gaps? And where do we need to make this system more seamless? So you'll see items in our budget. And in these items, you'll see a lot of offsets, too. Some of the reasons some of the dollars are small for these items is because if you, for example, have more mobile crisis mental health units, then you have fewer emergency room visits. So we're really trying to kind of move in a smart direction. So there's more earlier intervention, more care coordination. We're expanding our mobile crisis teams to more regions of the state, especially in greater Minnesota, where these are really desperately needed. So there's a lot more here. There's a lot of small things that we have identified as roadblocks in our mental health system. For example, we have a set of providers called ARMS providers, and they provide a lot of services in the community, you know, that can help people so they don't have to be in Anoka, which is, as we know, very expensive and not where people want to be. But we weren't, frankly, paying those providers enough. So we are doing things within our budget so that we can pay them more so that they'll be able to provide those services. And in the long term, that saves the state of Minnesota money. So there's some of those sorts of adjustments, as well as kind of addressing the need to really beef up our community services for, you know, for people with mental illness. We, you know, there's been a lot of talk about, do we have enough psychiatric beds in the state of Minnesota? I mean, and from my perspective, we have enough psychiatric beds, but we're not using them as well as we should. There are people in those psychiatric beds that could be treated in the community. And if we build up the community supports and treat them in the community, then we have the psychiatric beds available for the people that are need them. What we have is we have too many people that are using those psychiatric beds, let's say in Anoka, and to some degree at Security Hospital, who could be in the community. So part of this budget is really trying to provide the support so they are in the community and that those beds are available for people who need them, who often now are having to spend too much time in community hospitals and sometimes even in jails. So there are a lot of pieces that we're using and identifying to try and do that, but that is the overall goal. And that really is also our overall goal if you look at the next slide and what we're calling kind of our transition to community proposals. You know, once again, kind of part of our overall look at mental health continuum. And these really, we have identified a pot of money in this in the governor's proposed budget to really help with especially moving people out of security hospital. We have people in security hospital today that, you know, have been there often for many, many years. They've gone through our transition program. Our team says they could be served in the community, but if they're in the community, they need more support. We can't just release these people and say, go buy an apartment. You know, we need to provide more supports to make that successful. And so this is really an effort to supplement our other ways of supporting these individuals so that they can move them into the community. You know, and if you think about kind of our cost of security hospital of over $500 a day, you know, it's once again, there are some real set-offs here in our budget, and it also makes those more beds in security hospital available to those who need them. And, you know, it's also, can I just say, only fair. You know, if we have people at security hospital, and these are people who are committed as mentally ill and dangerous, so we can't just, I can't as commissioner just on my own say, you know, you go. There's a whole court process for that. But when people have successfully been through treatment, you know, 8, 10, 12 years, made really hard work, worked through our process all the way up to transitions, you know, they then have passes, they've worked hard, they need and deserve. And it's only fair that they be able to move into the community. But we need some additional supports to make that happen. One of the reasons, and I apologize, I'm starting to lose my voice here, so I'll just maybe be quick on the last of the couple things, and then I'll take a deep breath and you all can ask me questions. We also really have a lot of proposals that you'll see when you look at our budget to deal with program integrity issues. These overall spend money in some places and, you know, save us money in other places. But I really feel as commissioner that we need to do more to make sure that we're protecting taxpayer dollars that are invested in our services. And we also need to do a better job with internal audits at the department. And so there's some spending here on beefing up our internal audits to make sure that we are spending our money wisely, but also beefing up our new Office of Inspector General, which we created last year, to be much more proactive in preventing and going after fraud where we find it. As I said, because there's savings in some parts, spending in others, these are budget neutral overall, but I think this is really the right thing to do, and happy, you know, to take other ideas, work with you on other ideas in this area, but this is our kind of best assessment talking to others at this time. Some other key initiatives that I don't, well, I'm not going to go into in as much detail, but county performance, management system. We have some dollars in here to continue to move towards more outcome-based performance for counties. We've been working closely with the counties on this. We think, once again, this is the right direction, and there's money in this budget from reallocations to do that, where we are really looking at and evaluating counties based on outcomes. not just on process measures. And as we do that, I think it's only fair to say, okay, what are the process measures then that we no longer need? And that will be part of our conversation with counties as well. We have a number of items in the governor's budget which kind of continue our smart purchasing initiatives, where we're trying to use our dollars more, the additional dollars that we're putting in the budget for quality improvement, to really start, for an example, pay-for-performance, and these are additional dollars we want to start now for our home and community-based providers. This is one where it's, you know, relatively small dollars starting out, but once we have that system in place, and really I will certainly acknowledge that there are large numbers in the tails, which, you know, we, you know, fought for. We think that those are providers that need additional funding. They do a critical job, but we all want at least part of their funding to be based on pay-for-performance, and that's important to us. You'll see the same. We've reallocated things to give rate increases for the first time to nursing homes. A small amount that would go to everyone, but the rest that once again would be based up on quality performance. But we really need to invest in our long-term care structure. Our Minnesota Sex Offender Program, what we have in this budget is a number that if we do nothing, this is the growth that will be in that program. And that's the reality. We are hopeful, and I know, Mr. Chair, you are very active in these conversations, that we get recommendations from our Sex Offender Task Force, which on a bipartisan basis we can at least start to move forward, so that we do not just pay for continued growth. Certainly some of this money then could be used to fund some of those initiatives. I would also say that we, at the department, we recently issued an RFI, a request for information, which will be due at the end of February, which is asking providers in this state and counties, and we'll also have our state-operated services folks respond to this as well, say, what could you do to care for some subset of these individuals in the community? How much would that cost? What would the treatment look like? What would the security look like? So that because we want all of you to have a better basis for making decisions about options for that treatment going forward. But in the short term, we felt we had to continue to fund the growth, because if we do nothing, we have to make sure that we protect the public. Systems modernization, this is our computer infrastructure, which is, you all know, we desperately need, I think most of you know, to update. We are running systems that are 30 years old, and we can't even, find people to work on them that speak the languages, those computer languages that were done from 30 years ago. We, one of the reasons that we were able to, I think, take such a global look and reprioritize in our budget and fund things like, our initiatives for children and some of the things we're doing in mental health is because of some, I think, very good contracting that our healthcare administration did with the health plans. As you know, we put our large managed care contracts out to bid, through competitive bidding process 2 years ago. We got substantial savings for that. We also, as part of the 2011 budget negotiation, and this was something I certainly supported and worked hard on, put caps on the growth of those. But our negotiations for our 2013 contracts, we came in even under those 2% caps. So we had savings there because we held basically the savings there flat. And that got us an additional $60 million in federal and state savings. So $30 million of that is helping to fund some of these initiatives. One of the ones we are particularly glad to be able to fund, and you'll see that in this budget proposal from us, there's very few words restore. I mean, as I said, I think last time I was here, yes, it was very difficult to cut from the projected human services budget about $1 billion. But our approach here is not, okay, we're going to go backwards and try and restore that. We think a number of those things really hard and, frankly, at the time, necessary. One where we are restoring is Merck. And we are really taking some of the money that we got from the savings from the contracts, savings from the MCOs, and restoring Merck. We think that was a critical one because Merck is a funding to really help train doctors, especially physicians from greater Minnesota, and especially primary care physicians. And we've kind of been very clear that that's the focus we want for this additional, for this restoration, is up on primary care, and particularly those physicians that will stay in greater Minnesota. But with bringing 145,000 more people onto our public programs, it's, that insurance will be meaningless if we don't have people to serve them. So we were very clear with some of the savings we got from the MCO contracts to be able to fund Merck, to help train those physicians in the future. And we also used some of those savings to make strategic investments where we saw access problems if we didn't. So we propose a 5% increase to dentists. I think those of you who have been on this committee for a while know we have a real dental access problem in the state of Minnesota, especially in greater Minnesota. So we, and the last time the dentist got a across-the-board rate increase was, I think, 14 years ago. So we are proposing that. We think that's critical just to get access for enrollees. We are also proposing, on our fee-for-service side, increases for physicians and a small increase for hospitals. If you look at all of the states in our Medicaid fee-for-service programs, we pay doctors, I think we rank 47 today out of the 50 states. And I don't think we can expect physicians to care for 145,000 more if we don't do something about that. So that was part of the prioritization that we made, wanting to do the best for people and in a way that we thought was only fair. You know, with that, Mr. Chair, members, I'm happy to take questions. I do want to say, as I think the governor has said, you know, this is a starting place. This was our best effort based on what we knew at the time. And we know many of you have expertise that will contribute to a better discussion and probably in the long term a better budget for the Department of Human Services. But we do feel like this is a very good starting place for us. But we welcome input, new direction, better ideas.
Commissioner, I really want to thank you for all your work and for using what sounds to me like the last of your words for a day or two to share these thoughts with us, and want to encourage you to make sure you rest your voice enough that you and the governor can do a good job when you go out to meet with Commissioner Sebelius to help advocate for the BHP. You know, I think as far as a general direction, there's a lot to really applaud in the work that you've done. And certainly, as we get into this, there will be conversations about whether these are exactly the right approaches, and we're really looking forward, I think, collectively to engaging in that conversation and getting into more depth as to, you know, how you've approached things and why, and adding our thoughts as we go. But the focus on kids, particularly around the family supports to help kids succeed and break those generational poverty issues that have been plaguing us for so long. The focus on mental health supports is something that we've all been working on for so long. Enhancing our home and community-based services using smarter tools to approach that and provide the right care at the right time is just critical. Some of the long-term care and nursing home investments, you know, certainly really glad to see those dollars on the bottom line. We'll talk about, you know, where you came up with that approach, and there might be some additional approaches to think through. But again, and leveraging savings elsewhere in the budget is the right approach. I mean, I think that your general take that, you know, HHS has done a lot of the budget balancing around this place. Through the last 10 years of deficits. But we are where we are, and I think it would be wrong to try to just go back and put a whole bunch more money at these problems. I think we have room to do smart reforms and really spend our money more wisely and do right by the people of Minnesota and get to a stable place where we can move forward with this level of expenditures. And I think what you've done here really is a good starting place. And really want to applaud those efforts. And with that, I mean, I guess we'll open it up to a few questions from members if they have any. All right. Well, I mean, I guess Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner. It's good to see you again. Sorry to hear you're not feeling well, and I agree. I won't put much on you. I think the one thing that I sense is in your heart a lot that's special interest for me is the North Star Care for Children. And so maybe just a real brief how you envision that little nugget in your presentation here.
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, thank you for sharing that compassion for these children with me. And Assistant Commissioner Aaron Sullivan Sutton will talk more about this. But really what we're proposing to do is to bring our adoption assistant kind of payments in line with our foster care payments for these particular children in foster care, not the ones that are easier to adopt, the younger ones, but particularly the older ones. So as I said, now we just – our incentives are very skewed. And so we really want to put more money into the adoption assistance. But what we're really doing is just saying we're going to have – we have three different programs now that deal with this. We're going to make it one program, easier for counties to deal with, I think easier for parents who are adopting to deal with, easier for us to deal with, so we get some efficiencies there. But we try and bring up those adoption assistance payments because we know it's not just – the adoption process. These are families that are going to need support because these are children. They're in our foster care system because they have been abused and neglected, and they have special needs. And so this will really provide the funding for those families to be able to make that adoption successful in the long term. But thank you for the question, Senator.
I'd have to add my perspective to this as well, a great deal of passion and a long history of working with foster care issues and adoption issues as well, and really looking forward to hearing more from Aaron Sullivan Sutton as well on that, and just really going to try to make sure that we are still doing right by our foster parents. Historic versions of this have really proposed to undercut our foster care system in the pursuit of permanence. And that's something that I'm going to need to look at carefully. I see that there's money there to support these efforts, and that's the right direction. So Minnesota doesn't fare well in the national rankings of finding permanent homes for our children that are taken into foster care, and it's something that we really need to take very seriously and look for the root causes of why we're there, and certainly financial incentives needs to be discussed. But it's something we'll dig into a lot deeper. I read the budget pages. There's a lot of fleshing out to do from what we've been provided so far. But I really do look forward to that conversation and hope that we can get the right balance in the system for our most vulnerable children. So any other questions for the commissioner?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Claussen.
Thank you. Good morning, and thank you. Good overview. Could you expand a little bit on doubling the access to school-based mental health services, please?
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'd be delighted to. You know, and maybe I could just do this by telling a story. I first learned a lot about this when I was up on the Iron Range. On the range, they have a collaboration between the range mental health system and a lot of the school districts have come together there, you know, plus some of our mental health providers in the community. And what they do is, and the school districts provide some of the funding, DHS provides some of the funding, and they have employees of the Range Mental Health Center actually in certain schools. And I got to talk with some of those mental health workers. So they're not school district employees. They're employees of the mental health system, but there's kind of a set of funding that supports their work. But because they're there, they get referrals for kids who may need help earlier that are, you know, spotted by teachers or social workers. They build relationships with the kids. They're more trusted, so people seek them out because they're there on site. Now, they're not there every day, but like one of them was saying, she spends 2 days at one high school in the district and 2 days or 3 days at the other. But because we have mental health workers there, you know, they're able to kind of, I think, intervene earlier, spot things, make the appropriate referrals. And also, especially when you're dealing with teenagers, there are a lot of substance abuse issues. We also are able to kind of spot earlier and get these kids into treatment. Getting parents to initially identify even some of these issues, sometimes that's hard. And then just the whole getting kids to treatment who need the mental health work, or, you know, to appointments. After school with parents' working schedules, sometimes hard. So having that available, this is a very evidence-based program, and it's shown that you just really have better mental health outcomes for those children. And also then we're treating through the mental health system some things that otherwise just end up treating as disciplinary actions in our schools. So this really is focused on just doubling the number of districts that we provide our funding for. I mean, the districts will have to provide some funding too, but, you know, we're not going to be forcing anyone into this, but we have more districts that want to do this with us. And our thought, Senator, is to focus those opportunities for the districts where we have the greatest disparities, because we have a lot of health disparities in this state, racial and cultural disparities. We also have disparities, basically geographic disparities. So that's why we really want to try and focus this. We think we'll reach a lot of children this way.
Thank you. We're gonna spend at least two more days going over budget detail with assistant commissioners, going through with more detail on the sheets. So, I mean, if we can let the commissioner off soon here, that'd be good. Do you need to ask? I know Senator Benson.
Just one last
Senator
comment.
Clausen.
Thank you. I know that this is an area that is of great need. Mm-hmm. I have experience working in the schools. If you talk to school counselors and others, the mental health issues are on the rise, and we really need to address that. So I appreciate that, and my voice is matching yours.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. For very brief indulgence, you're talking about school-based mental health services and it being based on disparities. And I'm just going to make an early plug. Anoka-Hennepin is a really large district, and so if you look at the district level, the disparities are not so obvious as they might be in other school districts. And so I will be advocating as we go forward for my district, but I wanted to mention it early. I don't want success in one community masking struggles in another part of our district. So.
Point well taken. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you, Commissioner Jessen, for offering us your time.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and members. I look forward to working with you.
It's going to be good. With that, you know, maybe I will. I told members earlier we're going to try to have counsel step us through all of the various documents in front of us, understand how to navigate them, and find the pieces that you're interested in. And we have a couple of documents here, several actually. So with that, maybe we can step through them and get people oriented.
Mr. Chairman, sorry.
Yeah, Senator Kiffmeyer.
One quick question. As I kind of looked through these, I saw several very helpful links.
Yes.
If we had an electronic copy, that makes it really easy to go use those links. Will we get those electronic copies?
I believe they've already been sent. We can send them
okay.
An electronic copy so you can follow those
links. Can we get
links.
The full benefit out of
Absolutely.
These materials?
Yep.
Thank you.
Yeah, good point, Senator Kiffmeyer.
Mr. Chair and members, you have three stapled together packets, for lack of a better word here. The first one is white and looks like this. It says Human Services Governor's Changes on the top. This document is from MMB. This is the budget document that was released by that agency yesterday. It provides a very brief summary of each of the governor's proposals and a brief explanation of the fiscal aspects of those proposals, showing the change or the impact on the general fund and other funds where that is relevant. For any one of these, or not any one of them, but most of them are cross-referenced with this FF2 in the margin on the left-hand side. That is a cross-reference to this yellow packet of documents, which is from the Department of Human Services and provides more detail on the programmatic aspects of these proposals, although not necessarily in all cases, more detail on the fiscal aspects of the proposals. And you'll also note that there are some proposals on this list that are not cross-referenced to this list. So presumably the department has concluded that the explanation in this list is sufficient. The third thing that you have is a copy of the spreadsheet that we use in this committee. It looks like this. Fortunately for all of us, we all use the same spreadsheet. The governor's proposal, the department, everybody, the House uses the same spreadsheet. We share it back and forth. In the past, I've received a lot of comments about this spreadsheet that is confusing to folks. And there's a lot of information here. It's a very complex budget. Some of these proposals are very complex as well. I think it might be helpful to just look at one, and it's on the first page on line 101. This is the proposal to implement the optional MA expansion to 138%. And as you can see on, you know, these other two documents, they just show you the bottom line numbers. But if you want to understand what the governor is proposing and how it interacts among, in this case, the Healthcare Access Fund and the General Fund, this will explain some things to you. You may end up with more questions, but there are some answers here. So on line 102, you can see that there is an impact on the general fund and that the total impact is a savings of $263 million. On line 103, there's also an impact on the Healthcare Access Fund, and for that fund, the overall savings is $110 million. So those two items, those two totals, add up to the total on the first line, on line 101, of a savings of about $373 million. The lines below that in the smaller typeface, if you just look at line 104, the GF is a reference to the fund, in this case the general fund. The 33 is irrelevant for your purposes. The FC is a reference to the part of the MA program that is being affected, in this case, is families and children. I point that out because I know a lot of folks are often interested in nursing facilities and the long-term care providers and such. So if you turn the page and get to page 3, line 181, this is a Reform 2020 proposal called First Contact Simplification, Access, and Transition Support. And if you go to line 183 and just read across, you'll see that those notations are for LF and LW. LF is for basically nursing homes, long-term care facilities. LW is for long-term care waivers. Again, this is one of the more complex proposals that I have seen. So it has a number of provisions that affect a number of different areas of the budget. And they're all well described here. One thing that appears to me at first glance to be well documented here are additional FTEs that are included in these proposals. So in this case, if you look at line 191, you'll see that there are, in parentheses, notice noted that this proposal includes in the first year 6 additional FTEs and in the second and subsequent years an additional 7 FTEs. There appears to be some attempt throughout this document to provide that information somewhat consistently. Again, I know there's a lot of information here. I think it's helpful. You may or may not. If you want some help, you know, walking through and sort of understanding this thing, I'd be more than happy to sit down with any of you and talk through it or answer any questions you have now.
Note to members, your ruler is your friend. Everyone will find one in their folder. Keep it in there, and as we go through these budget documents, they really do help you try to get a bead on this. It's beside your folder today. So, you know, a couple of things. The general purpose of these overview hearings is to really give all members and the public a really good understanding of what the administration has proposed. I guess I need to say at the outset, this is a little different than what we've seen in prior years because MMB has changed these budget pages. And really, they don't provide the level of depth that we've become used to. This used to be several three-ring binders and really allowed the Department of Human Services to put a lot of their information into the MMB system, and it was one consolidated document. That's changed. And so we're working, and the department has done a phenomenal job of trying to create this additional level of detail to help step us through and understand, but we're all trying to work through this new environment and make sure that members are able to gain access efficiently and accurately to whatever information we need in order to help have the right framework for moving forward. So, I mean, the department has really done an excellent job, the Department of Human Services, in trying to help bridge the gap from what we used to get to what we need for today. So with that, and those are issues that we'll, you know, if you have ideas about how to better approach this, do let me know, let the administration know, the Department of Human Services, MMB, and with that, we'll jump in pretty quick here. But Senator Carlson.
Yep. Mr. Chair, do we have a glossary for the newbies here that can help us understand the all of the abbreviations?
You know,
families and children.
We can get that. I know Senator Sharon produced one of those for the policy committee. Maybe she'd be willing to share that work and pass it out in this committee as well. We can have one of those.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And yeah, there's a lot of them, and they take a while. So with that, any other general questions? Senator Sharon.
I'd all be interested, too, in that was another thing that was part of that big budget document was all this background information like that, but, you know, what the meanings of the levels of poverty are
mm-hmm.
and what it means and how it breaks off. There's a
yep.
sheet like that that we can provide everybody for this committee, too.
Yep. You know, one thing I always tell people is the poverty levels aren't really a mystery. It starts at about $11,000 for one person is 100% of federal poverty level. It adds $4,000 for every additional person in the household. So, you know, for a household of two, it's $15,000, you know, roughly. For a household of three, it's $19,000, you know, and if you want to go from 100 to 150, multiply it by 1.5. If you want to go from 100 to 200, it's what's that? It's not too complicated. I mean, come on.
It was okay when you were adding. Multiplication.
You can. I don't know. It's all there. Find a couple of placeholders in the spreadsheet. But Senator Sharon provided that as well. But that's what it is. It's not rocket science. So with that, and those are good items to add to help people understand things. So in that vein, any other ideas that we can do to help make sure that you have the tools that you need to engage fully in the conversation and really have the base that you feel you need. And I know that the department has made themselves broadly available, too. If members want to develop specific expertise in policy areas, I really want to encourage that. The department really wants to encourage that, and we'll work offline with you. We'll only be able to get to a certain level of depth right here during full committee time, but there's going to be much more work to be done behind the scenes, and I know that the department will make all of their staff and resources available to any member who really wants to dig in. So we'll take advantage of that. Senate Counsel and Research also is a phenomenal resource.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Franzen.
The only thing I would add is if there's any opportunity to get the items before the committee so we have a chance to review, that would be helpful. That would just be my comment.
Today we couldn't because these were actually not even public documents till this morning. This was this is the rollout of the budget sheets. So anytime we are able to get things in advance, I do understand that that's important to members, and we'll send it electronically and do our best. So with that, any further questions? And we are running behind the time we were hoping to be, but these are important, and it's important that members understand how to approach this process. So, Senator Benson.
And Mr. Chair, thank you. And if Senate Counsel and staff, when they're moving through documents, I know my first time through, everybody feels like they're used to it. Every once in a while, say, now we're on page such and such, line this.
Yes.
It really helped by the time we got to conference committee to have you speaking that way. And so for people who haven't seen these documents before, it's pretty intimidating, and yep. I found that helpful.
And, you know, I do that myself on occasion. And if you look around the table and see folks are struggling to find it, you know, a helpful comment, you know, is viewed by the chair as just that, a helpful comment to help people navigate, because I understand we have a lot of documents in front of us, and it's hard to always track. So we do our best. Council can help, and I'd welcome you to just kind of butt in and say it too if I'm not tracking and seeing that people aren't where they need to be. So that's all to the good. With that, we're going to start with Assistant Commissioner Scott Leitz with the review of the budget proposals for health care. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Scott Leitz, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner for health care at the Department of Human Services. And, Mr. Chair, on the walkthrough, I'm going to be working off of the yellow packet of fast facts. And what I'll be cross-referencing will be that document pack to the document that Mr. Albrecht referenced earlier, which is the Human Services Governor's Changes document. And I think in the margin of that document to the left, there should be a FF number that'll reference to which page of the yellow I'm working off of. So I'm going to start, Mr. Chair, by talking about the first Fast Facts document, which is on page 2, which is expanding medical assistance eligibility. And that really encompasses three items in the governor's change document. The first item makes Medicaid eligibility and enrollment changes. And this is really what Commissioner Jessen referenced as some of the streamlining and improvements that we'll be making for programs that allow people to enroll in an easier manner and stay on our programs. I'll briefly go through what the elements are. As the commissioner mentioned, this change item is really about getting people who are currently eligible for the medical assistance program enrolled in that program. And because of that, this item has a cost of about $166 million for the biennium. The requirements to and these are items that the Affordable Care Act really requires states to do as part of compliance with that act. It includes a new income counting methodology, streamlined online application verification processes, an improved renewal process, and some other eligibility changes that I'll briefly touch on. The first major item here is a movement to what's called the modified adjusted gross income method, which uses income and household information on tax returns following IRS rules to count income for Medicaid eligibility. This is a change from how we currently do this. All asset requirements and income disregards that we currently have for eligibility determination are eliminated moving to this methodology, and they're replaced with a standard 5% income disregard. And so when I talk a little bit later about the medical assistance expansion up to 133% of poverty, you'll oftentimes hear that referred to 138% of poverty because we'll be applying that 5% disregard. There are a number of populations to whom this enrollment change or applies to, its eligibility change applies to, and these will be populations that will ultimately be eligibility determined through the health insurance exchange. It'll be pregnant women and infants, children, parents, and our adult expansion group up to 133 of poverty. The disabled and the elderly are not subject to this change in eligibility determination. The second major element of this item relates to the fact that we will be required and to accept applications online by mail, by phone, and in person, and to verify the information that we receive on applications electronically through interactions with existing data sources that are out there. So this will streamline the process for individuals as they'll actually be able to apply online, which is something they're not easily able to do today. And then the information we receive is going to be verified on the back end via using existing systems. There's a real push in the implementation of this law to not require excessive collection of information, which is something that has sort of bogged down our system over the years because we have to collect and recollect information from individuals, but rather to use existing data information sources to ping against to make sure that we're collecting accurate information.
One second. Assistant Commissioner Lights, how many change pages do you have in the health care?
Mr. Chair, I believe there are 13 change pages.
I'm wondering. I know Senator Benson has said she had a question. I'm hoping that we can allow Mr. Lights to go through the 13 pages and kind of have a little bit of a discussion afterwards. I'm getting worried about actually getting through stuff, but if you have a quick question.
Actually, that was my question, Mr. Chair, is how much detail were we going to go in at this point? And I have a lot of questions, and I'm afraid an appointment with Mr. Lights might not be something he looks forward to, but it might be a more effective use of time. And so I just want you to set the tone for how far we're going to dig in today.
Right. I mean, I have a lot of questions that aren't answered as well. And I think Mr. Lights looks forward to a meeting with either you or I, Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I am very delighted to meet with any member of the legislature.
That's what I thought.
Very clear.
Honestly, and we can have much further discussions. I want to dig into each of these, but with 13 change pages, we'll never let Mr. Lights go. We'll never get to Lauren Coleman today, and we'll never get through this. So let's
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, the 13 pages.
I'll keep moving, Mr. Chair.
All right.
The third sort of major element of this is renewal changes that relate to 12-month eligibility, and that's really moving from a current eligibility determination period of 6 months to 12-month redeterminations, as well as what are called ex parte renewals, where if a person we're required to use information that we currently have to determine whether people are eligible on an ongoing basis for programs. This item also expands medical assistance for former foster care children up through the age of 26. And allows for presumptive eligibility determinations at hospitals where hospitals can collect a modest amount of information at the point of care to ensure that an individual and make a determination if that individual is likely eligible for Medicaid, allows them to have certainty around payment during the processes. And these changes to eligibility enrollment will add an additional average enrollment to the program of about 65,000 people. The second item that is included on this fast fact yellow sheet relates to expanding medical assistance coverage to maintain coverage for children and pregnant women up to 275% of poverty. This is really what's called a maintenance of effort item in the Affordable Care Act. It requires that states maintain eligibility levels as of the date of the enactment. And since Minnesota Care covered children up to 275% of poverty through a medical assistance, which is called Section 1115 waiver, it's our reading of the law, and discussions with CMS have confirmed this, our reading was that we would need to cover children in the medical assistance program moving forward up to 275% of poverty. And so this item does that. This change results in an additional average monthly enrollment of about 106,000 kids in MA, about a little bit less than half of which weren't previously covered by any public program. So we're bringing in about 47,000 additional children under this item.
Mr. Lights, I guess it says on our sheets that about 60,000 of those are from Minnesota Care. So, and then the other almost half are uninsured today.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Yeah.
And the third item here is on is the implementing the optional Medicaid expansions up to 138% of poverty. The Affordable Care Act allows for states to expand Medicaid programs for adult populations up to 133% of poverty. That's an optional item. The governor is proposing to do that. The population here is currently covered either in medical assistance or Minnesota Care at a 50% match rate. For the childless adult population that would be covered by this, we will receive 100% full federal funding. There's another group that would be covered by this expansion, parents between 100 and 133% of poverty, and 19 and 20-year-olds between 100 and 133% of poverty will receive a 50% match rate on those groups. So this proposal to do that, then in a sense, you have folks who are currently being covered under Minnesota Care at a 50% match rate. For the adult single adult group, that'll move to 100% full federal funding. So you have savings that accrue to the Healthcare Access Fund as a result of that. We will move about 53,000 people from Minnesota Care to medical assistance under this proposal by fiscal 2015, and then add an additional 34,000 people who are currently uninsured as a result of this expansion.
And then, you know, just as guideposts, I think I've been watching, I think most people are there, but this was three items on the MMB document on one page of the HHS document. So on the first two pages, you'll see FF2 for three items. Those were all off of the Fast Facts, page two. Just a real-world example of how we're working through this. I saw some members struggling with that as far as your guideposts.
Mr. Chair, I'll try to reference as well as I can along the way so that folks don't get too lost. One point I'd like to make is that when you combine these three items, as I mentioned, the first one I mentioned regarding Medicaid eligibility changes, as well as the maintenance of the streamlining of eligibility, as well as the maintenance of effort on children up to 275, those have costs associated with them. The expansion of the population to 138% of poverty actually has savings associated with it because of the federal funding that's associated with it. And when you net out those three items, it's a net savings to the state's bottom line of about $117 million. And the reason I say that, Mr. Chair, is just so that you're aware, as we move to Fast Fact Sheet number 4, which is the new Minnesota Care demonstration waiver. Some of the funding, the savings that I just referenced, will be supplemented with some additional savings.
It's on the very last page of the MMB, as people look at it.
Yes.
It's on page 27.
To make it wildly understandable, Mr. Chair,
yes,
it's
exactly
on the last page.
I don't know why. It just is.
And Mr. Chair, Commissioner Justin, I think, talked at some length about this in her remarks. This is really a placeholder right now for what we know are ongoing discussions around the future of the Minnesota Care program. That's a program that currently covers folks up to 275% of the federal poverty guidelines for families with kids, 250% of poverty for single adult populations. It's been in existence for 20 years now. The administration in collaboration with many of you are actively working with the federal government to try to secure funding to continue this program through an option in the Affordable Care Act called the Basic Health Plan option that allows us to receive 95% of the funding that would otherwise go to cover these individuals in the health insurance exchange. Those discussions, as the commissioner said, are aggressively ongoing, I would say. And we do have another call scheduled with CMS later this week. And I know that the governor and the commissioner are planning to meet directly with Secretary Sebelius on this issue. What this item does is to really lay out some broad guidelines of what we would be seeking in a new Minnesota Care waiver. I'll just briefly touch on those. We want to improve Minnesota care to include benefits that would be equal to or better than what would be allowed for in the exchange, reduced cost sharing as compared to exchange coverage. We would need to do certain things to on the eligibility side to comply with the modified adjusted gross income calculation. Those are sort of behind-the-scenes things that would need to occur. But at a real practical level, a couple of the things we would be doing would be eliminating the $10,000 hospital limit, which is currently for some adult populations on the program, the $1,000 copay, which exists for some adult populations, as well as the four-month waiting period on the program. What the budget does is to set aside $300 million in funding as a contingency as those discussions move forward. We know we have 117 in savings. When I netted out those first items I talked about, that was supplemented to get it to a total of $300 million that's set aside for contingencies. The next fast fact page I'll turn to is page 6. That is referenced on
page six of our MMB document.
As a first place. The first item I'll discuss here, and this is really related to smart healthcare purchasing. We placed an emphasis in this budget on continuing some of the efforts that we've made to make our purchasing efforts at the department better and more effective and efficient. The first item is contract savings related to managed care organizations. And as the commissioner said, what this item does is we, in the 2011 budget, as part of that budget agreement, caps were placed on growth in the capitation rates that could be paid to managed care organizations. It was capped at 2% growth for subsequent years. For 2013, what the department did when we negotiated contracts is we actually negotiated a rate that was pretty much flat for 2013 compared to 2012. And because the forecast contained a 2% growth rate, we were able to capture some of the savings related to coming in below that. And that's what the is referenced by the net change item that you see of around $60 million in savings as a result of that. The second item is listed on
page 8 of our MMB documents.
And this relates to and it'll be the one I'll talk about next is actually on the bottom of page 8, 340B drug reimbursement. The 340B program is a drug discount program that's administered through the Federal Health Resources and Services Administration, or HRSA. Hospitals that do a large amount of Medicaid, safety net clinics, federally qualified health centers, critical access hospitals, children's hospitals, and freestanding cancer centers are eligible to participate in this program, and they can buy drugs at a lower rate than other individuals can through this program. Per federal law, state Medicaid programs cannot invoice drug manufacturers for rebate on the 340B acquired drugs because doing so would equate to double discounting. They're already discounted, so we're not able to get rebates on these drugs. So in the past, the way that that we've administered this program is through individual agreements with the handful of 340B participants in the state. Those participants agreed to submit claims to DHS at a discounted rate, and the intent of the agreement was to ensure that DHS was held harmless from that loss of drug rebate that we would have otherwise gotten. What's changed over time is that a lot more entities are now eligible for 340B, and so we have a ton more eligible providers who are participating in this program. And so these individual agreements that we have simply become unworkable because there's so many of them. And you sort of add to that the fact that the amount of rebate that's available on Medicaid drugs has increased significantly. And as a result, the current agreements that we have resulted in a situation where we actually, as DHS, pay more for the 340B discounted drugs than we do for drugs purchased through community pharmacies net of the rebate we receive on them. So this proposal really tries to remedy that situation, and it establishes a single uniform rate for 340B acquired drugs. We base that rate on a nationally available benchmark, which is called the Wholesale Acquisition Cost, or the WAC. The proposed rate that we would be paying would be that wholesale acquisition cost rate minus 44%. And that's the rate that we calculate would hold us harmless from the loss of the drug rebates that we would otherwise have received. I would note that this new rate should still provide margin for the 340B entities. We think that the acquisition cost for them is that rate minus is the WAC minus 60%. So there's still a little margin built in for participating providers. And we believe that this would allow us to achieve some savings. I think the governor's budget has a savings of about $5.2 million over the biennium for this item. The next item is on page 7.
Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
I just have a question for you. were we wanting to hold our questions to the end? We're just going through so many areas, or ask them as we go.
Mr. Leitz has about 13 change pages to get through. If we're able to hold, I mean, we'll just never get through this if we – I know there's certainly additional levels of detail that we all want and
Mr.
need.
Mr. Chairman,
but I mean,
I'm just fine. I just wanted to
okay.
check. Thank you.
At the end of this, we'll open it up for some questions, as many as we can get to.
The next item, Mr. Chair and members, is on the bottom of the white document, page 7, supplemental rebates for diabetic test strips. This moves all claims for diabetic test strips to the pharmacy benefit. We currently administer this through both durable medical equipment and pharmacy. All claims will be processed at the point of sale, which will bring additional opportunities for program integrity as well as utilization management for this program. Folks are able to receive drugs, test strips, I should say, either through a pharmacy or through a DME provider. Most people right now receive it through the pharmacy channel. About 90% of our claims for diabetic test strips are filled through that channel. What we will do under this proposal is negotiate with diabetic test strip manufacturers for rebates and develop a preferred test strip brand list that folks could access. Brands that aren't on the list will still be available, but they'll be prior authorized. So if there's a medical necessity for it, something that's not on the preferred list, that can still be gotten if there's a medical necessity there. And this, we're following the lead of several other state Medicaid programs that have been successful in implementing a similar solution to their program. And this item saves a little over $500,000 over the biennium. The fourth item on Fast Facts, page number 6, relates to our state maximum allowable cost for specialty drugs, and that's on page 8 of the white document at the top. We establish a state maximum allowable cost, or SMAC, for specialty drug products and drugs available in generic formulations. It's the maximum rate that we pay for medication, basically. But currently, that only applies to drugs that are dispensed by a pharmacy. What this proposal does is to extend that to drugs that are dispensed in non-pharmacy settings, clinics, or outpatient settings. It eliminates what we believe might be an incentive to deliver those services in higher cost areas and really levels the playing field for this item. It has a modest savings of about $47,000. And the final item on Fast Facts, page number 6, is also just below that item on page 8 of the white document. This is a proposal to recalculate the reimbursement rate for child and teen checkups. We pay a bundled rate, a global rate for child and teen checkup services under the Medicaid program. has a number of services sort of bundled up in that. One of the pieces of this that was inadvertently included when we established the rate were costs associated with vaccines that are provided under what's called the Vaccines for Kids program, which is a no-cost program for providers. And what was happening, it was a free vaccine program, but we had charges associated with that. We shouldn't be paying for charges that for drugs that were administered for free. So what we're proposing to do is to back that out of the rate now. And so it lowers the rate from around $300 for that global rate to around $275. And I should mention savings on that is about $900,000. Moving to Fast Facts page 8, which is associated with the white page number 7, middle item. As Commissioner Justin mentioned, one of the things that we recognize is that as health reform moves forward and more individuals, whether through the exchange or through Medicaid expansions, come into coverage, we need to ensure that we have providers who are able to see those individuals. And so what this item does is to start to make some progress on establishing more stable and sustainable Medicaid payment rates for providers who are CR clients. They've received reductions in the past, certainly over the past decade, as the budgetary times were difficult. And so we're making some targeted service category investments here back into Medicaid payment rates. Let me give you one example. In 2009, the dental rates in Minnesota's Medicaid program covered about 40% of retail fees that dentists receive otherwise. That compares to a national average of 60%. So we're paying significantly below, just as one example, in our dental program compared to other states. And so the bullet point list that you have on the yellow Fast Facts page 8 shows what the investments will be. It's a 2% increased investment in fee-for-service rates for inpatient hospital services, 3% for medical transportation and basic care services in our fee-for-service program. Basic care would include things like medical equipment, lab services, hospice services, dialysis, and so forth. Our outpatient hospital rates, a fee-for-service increase of 5%. Physician and professional services in Medicaid, including primary care and non-primary care, an increase of 5%. And then dental services in both our fee-for-service program and managed care, a 5% rate increase. That comes with a cost over the biennium of about $27 million. On page 9 of the Fast Facts document, corresponding to page 7 at the top, is an increase in funding for the Medical Education and Research Cost Fund, or the MERC Fund. Again, Commissioner Jessen spoke a little bit about this in her remarks. This is a program that is there to offset the costs for clinical training sites who train our medical professionals. It's been in business for a number of years, but has been reduced over time, again, in under pressures from the budget. What we propose to do in the governor's budget is to increase funding in the MERC program back to its fiscal year 11 level. This is particularly in recognition of the fact that as we have additional people coming into coverage, we want to make sure that we have the appropriately trained professionals to deal with them. It's particularly true of primary care, where there's shortages chronically. And as part of this, we will be proposing some formula changes in the way that the MERC fund is distributed. I want to make that clear so that there's an emphasis on ensuring that we do have the right folks being trained at the right places. So this adds over the biennium about another close to $13 million back into the MERC fund. Those are the Fast Fact sheets I have. Mr. Chair, there's a few more items I just want to mention, three more items that I should mention as a part of my pages.
Good.
The first is on page
6, I believe.
And this is an important item related to the Emergency Medical Assistance Program. Last year, we used one-time money to – well, I should back up for a second here – the Emergency Medical Assistance Program is a program that's used for covering the cost of services for people who otherwise wouldn't be eligible for the medical assistance program. And these would be folks who have an emergency that occurs, but because of
their documentation status or other things are not eligible for the medical assistance program. We reduced the benefits for those individuals in the 2011 budget. In the 2012 budget, we bought back certain services on a one-time basis, services related to cancer treatment and services related to dialysis for folks who have kidney issues. What this does is continue that buy back for cancer and dialysis into the future at a cost of about $5.3 million over the biennium. The next item, you'll have to go to the last page, page 27 of your white document. This is an item that's related to the health department's budget. Pages. They'll talk more about that when they have their budget, but they're doing some investments to strengthen the newborn screening program. Newborn screening program is paid for by a fee that's charged to insurers. Medical assistance program, being an insurer, bears a cost of that fee, and so the costs associated with the Medicaid costs associated with that health department item shows up on that item here. And the last item I have, Mr. Chair, is on page 26, and I think MMB is here as well, should this get into the weeds at all. Hopefully it won't. There's an existing transfer that occurs between the Health Care Access Fund and the General Fund of $96 million every biennium. What this item does is to balance that transfer across fiscal years. There's a fair amount of spending in the governor's budget in fiscal year 14 in the Healthcare Access Fund. We do a transfer to ensure that spending can occur in 14, but that transfer still occurs, so it's a shift of money between fiscals 14 and 15. And that has probably exhausted my vast knowledge of that item, Mr. Chair. I think if there are future other questions, MMB can probably field those.
Okay. You know, let's spend maybe 15 minutes with Commissioner Leitz asking some questions, and I would like to still try to get to Commissioner Coleman to go through the continuing care for a while today, but we've been informed that Commissioner Coleman can return tomorrow. He has a lot of change pages to get through. Mr. Leitz, are you able to return tomorrow at all if we don't get through questions?
Mr. Chair certainly can.
Okay. So let's get started. I'm sure that people have several questions. There's a couple of other items in the MMB that weren't covered necessarily. There was where did I find that? Something about the long-term care provider rates. Well, that'd be covered by Coleman, I'm sure.
Yes, this is Commissioner Coleman. I think we'll address that.
All right. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Leitz. Let's go back to Fast Facts, page 2 and 3. A lot of, and there are pools of money in different places, and so please help me understand. Last year we funded integrated online eligibility, and we had a federal draw. And now it sounds like you're doing the same thing, and I see there's funding for technology improvements in the department budget, but you're also talking about eligibility and enrollment changes. And so I'm seeing this pot of money possibly being in three places, and I don't want to presume anything nefarious, but in the exchange, they also are accessing integrated online eligibility money. And so I feel like the money might be being spent two and three times. Can you help me understand?
Mr. Light.
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, I can certainly attempt to do that, and I may ask Chuck Johnson or someone from the department also join me on some of the systems pieces that you're asking about. What's showing up primarily on the page that you see here is really related to the enrollment cost and the medical costs of the individuals who come into the programs. So you're absolutely right. There are changes that are occurring on the system side to do a better job of integrating in our programs. What the costs that are showing up in the healthcare budget really relate to are, as those people do come onto our program, how many of them are coming into the program, and what are the costs associated with the services that they receive, notwithstanding the costs that are associated with the systems work that's occurring as well.
Okay. Okay, and then if I may, I'm going to limit to these two questions, and then I'll talk offline. I had asked about the Magi provisions, and what if somebody doesn't have a tax return? How do they fit in this?
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, at a high level, I'll take a crack at that. I think we're certainly happy to follow up with additional detail as to how that occurs. You're absolutely right. There'll be a number of people who don't have tax returns and that won't have that ability to be able to do some of the verification that would otherwise occur. It'll still use that same methodology, but we'll still need to then work through with them individually what their eligibility, just as they do today, where county workers and others help people do their eligibility determinations. There'll still need that work will still need to occur. It just won't occur through the same channels, but it'll use the same methodology. So meaning that I think we'll be looking at income, counting income in the same way. It just won't be pinged against information that we currently are collecting because there's not a return on online for that.
Okay. Senator Hayden.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Lentz, to that point, I don't want to get too in the weeds here, but along with Senator Benson's question, what if there is a change in household income during the year? How do you account for that? Because the tax return, even if they had it, wouldn't reflect that.
Mr. Chair and Senator Hayden, so it's accounted for through a number of let me back up here. An individual is determined eligible based on sort of their return and the information that we collect through the sort of Magi rules that will be applied. Redeterminations are now made 12 months under the program. If there's an income change, the redetermination will be made at that point at 12 months. And if there's been a change in income, it'll be reflected in that redetermination period at that point. So if you have sort of a determination made in 2014 and 12 months later, we make a redetermination. If income has changed, individuals are either eligible or not eligible for programs based on that and will be eligible for tax credits depending on how their individual income has changed during that time period.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lights, can you go into a little more detail about the emergency medical assistance and if you are – is the department looking at addressing the nursing home hospital issue that is really getting to be a critical issue? And
Commissioner Lights.
Why that is not in here.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen, the issue that we refer to is one where individuals who are deemed to be who come in for an emergency are eligible for emergency medical assistance, but have their course of treatment in a hospital and then are ready to be discharged. At that point, are no longer necessarily emergent, and so the challenge has been finding sometimes places to actually discharge individuals to. And it has been certainly for some of the safety net hospitals a burden for them to care for these individuals and then find a place to be able to discharge them to. We do know that we're having, I would say, active ongoing discussions with the hospitals and the nursing homes on it. Nothing, the governor's budget doesn't directly affect that. I think we continue some of the coverage issues related to cancer and dialysis, but we know that issue is one that needs to be addressed and needs to be dealt with. It's our preference, I think, to work collaboratively with the hospital and nursing home community to find a solution that we can sort of all agree to as a way to do this. I would say that we're not quite there yet, but I think that there's been some good discussions that have been occurring on that issue.
Mr. Senator Chair. Rosen, a follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lights, will there have to be some supplemental funding for that? I would assume there...
Mr. Right. Chair, Senator Rosen, we don't anticipate that will be the case. I think what we want to be very clear on is when does emergency medical assistance sort of coverage end, and when to, and under what circumstances? And we've sort of really taken a view that under some agreements that we had with advocates on this issue, that basically the department looks to see. As an individual, if coverage sort of extends up until the point of when, if we were to cease the services that the individual is receiving, within 48 hours, there would be a high probability that they would need to go back in for emergency coverage. And I think what we'll want to work with is around that definition of when coverage, how long a care plan is good for, and what it looks like moving forward. I guess we're not anticipating it being a budget item. Certainly, if the solution is one where it would require that, certainly we'd be back on that talking with you all. But right now, we don't anticipate that being the case.
Thank you.
This is Senator Hayden.
So, I'm sorry, to that point, thank you, Mr. Chair, Commissioner Lynch. So isn't kind of the problem and kind of what I kind of see reaching, trying to find an explanation, is just because we're calling it emergency medical assistance when it's really much more people who have really troubling health care issues or really chronic health care issues that don't fit in our normal system. So really hard to cover folks. And it seems to me that if we continue to talk about it in the emergency assistance box, you're going to continue to struggle on how to deal with this, as opposed to saying that these are folks who, for whatever reason, don't fit in our normal MA, Medicaid service box, but they still need a lot of services. And we need to figure out how to pay for that and how to manage that. Because, you know, in your example, somebody has emergency medical assistance, they're ready to be discharged, they know nursing home or long-term care facility picks them up, they go wherever, they get sick again, they're coming right back to the emergency. I mean, we're just going to cycle these poor people back and forth. So it seems to me that we probably, to Senator Rose's point, are going to have to talk about more money, and we're going to have to really kind of say it what it is, which is not, you know, they may present with an emergency issue, but it really is a long-term chronic health issue that we don't have any other eligibility for them or any – no, they don't fit any other program. Would you kind of think that that's what we're dealing with?
Mr. Chair and Senator Hayden, I think that's extremely well stated. I think you're absolutely right. There's sort of two – I was addressing the very specific emergency medical assistance program, but you're absolutely right that there is I think a general need that we're going to have to think through collectively around how do we make sure that folks who may not have an emergent condition but are chronically ill and may not fit into the system right now because of the way that we've structured our eligibility categories, how we actually ensure that they're able to get the services that they need. And you make an excellent point, making sure that they get the services that they need in a way that's actually cost effective, because the way that we do it now, because of the, you know, this is, again, I think one of the holes that we really have in the net right now is that we're not doing a good job of coordinating care for those folks. I know that there's been some thinking that's been done by some of the safety net clinics and some of the safety net hospitals around ideas on that. And I think those are ones that merit some discussion, some looking at. But sure, I would agree with your point.
You know, one more thought, just in terms of orienting members to where and when we'll get into more, even more substantive discussions, because we are time limited in these overviews. You know, these are all governor's proposals, and correct me if I'm wrong, Assistant Commissioner, but, you know, these will be turned into a bill that'll have yellow jackets that'll come forward and somebody will carry it. And they'll actually have, you know, by the time they get here, a fiscal note that'll have all of the assumptions behind what the costs are, and it'll be much more fully developed, and we will have very substantive discussions on each and every single one of these items if it comes to pass that we decide to actually put it on our budget spreadsheets at the end of the day. So just so that nobody thinks that this is our last view and our last crack at digging below the surface, it is not. These will come forward as actual bills that will have an author sitting there before us with the support of the administration, presumably. And we will continue these. With that, Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And that's why I wanted to kind of focus on more of a larger picture, because I know there's so many more details that come that will answer a lot of those questions. But one of the concerns I have here is that on the particular issue on page 8, and this is the drug reimbursement, but it's mainly on the subject of drugs, pharmacy in general, both in the last couple years and also even just recently, we've heard some disturbing situations of shortages.
That's the MMB page 8, the white one, everybody.
Yes, sorry.
Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And it isn't necessarily specifically to that particular governor's change item. It's to more in general, to be really concerned about shortages. I mean, you can have a great program put in place to take care of, but if you can't get the drugs that are needed or that the providers need, we put so much pressure on that sometimes that we risk our ability to plan get them essentially needed. So on more of a larger picture issue rather than specifically to this particular budget item, could you just address that subject in general, what you're seeing in DHS and some of those issues?
Commissioner Lights.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, I might see if our pharmacy director, Sarah Drake, who knows a lot more about these issues than I do, could come to the table. I would say, just generally speaking, I think our approach in these pages is to understanding the question that you're asking. I think our general approach in these pages is to, for the drugs that we do purchase, to do so, I think, as prudently and effectively as we can. Certainly that's our approach. But I don't know, Sarah, if you have some thoughts on the question.
Sure. Thanks, Scott. Senator Kiffmeyer, we have heard about drug shortages, not so much directly related to the work we do. I mean, we pay for the medications that are used for our enrollees. But I have heard cases from certain hospitals, particularly around oncology drugs, that there's a shortage, particularly the older generic products. There's been some problems that the FDA has looked into as far as shedding certain plants. And then some drugs are just so low cost that the suspicion is that there's not a lot of manufacturers willing to make them. But what we're proposing in these budget pages on the 340B reimbursement, I think, as Scott mentioned, what we're trying to do is just ensure that the cost we pay for the drugs that are acquired through this 340B discount program, we're not paying more for those products than we're paying for the drugs we acquire through any other channel. So we're not really addressing the shortage issue. The shortage issue is out there. It's certainly bigger than us.
Ms. Drake, and if you could just state your name for the record.
Oh, sure. I'm Sarah Drake. I'm Pharmacy Program Manager at Minnesota Department of Human Services.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, I just on a follow-up on that.
Senator
Kiffmeyer. That was my approach, was to go a little bit beyond, and I agree with your things that you've done here. I think those are programmatic efficiencies, which are essential for you, and I think everything else, I don't agree with that. But I do think sometimes what we do here, we don't realize sometimes the possible effect these kinds of things can have in total to the market out there, and we are dependent upon their providing a product for us to fairly purchase. Thank you.
Thank you. I think with that, we're probably going to move on to Commissioner Coleman. Before I let you go, Commissioner Lights, on that point about there being bills for each of these items, do you guys have any idea when budget bills might be coming over this way for circulation?
Mr. Chair, I don't have that information. It's not that I'm withholding anything. I don't know the answer to that question. I don't think it's anything that we're trying to be secretive about. We can dig and see what I can find for you.
Great. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Since we have deadlines.
Commissioner Coleman, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, and we'll get you started anyway. Yes. And members, my understanding is that Commissioner Coleman is going to be working off of the MMB white sheets primarily, and on that you will see the fast facts cross-references, so you should be able to follow from there and read a little bit of additional information. And thank you again for working with us through this. It's
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. Good to be back with you again. Just to comment, we're also adapting to the new documentation and trying to manage within the information that's available. Just as an introduction, the Continuing Care Administration, again, is the part of the department responsible for the administration of the aging long-term care programs for people with disabilities and our older Minnesotans. We include developmental disabilities, chronic medical conditions, acquired or traumatic brain injuries, physical disabilities, people with HIV/AIDS, and again, older adults. The portion of the governor's budget is really focused on some significant themes that we've identified. First, empowering consumer participation, really involving our older adults and people with disabilities in decision-making. A continuous improvement and simplification. I know we always talk about simplification. We're really trying to get there. Promoting quality, providing incentives, and really focusing on having quality long-term care services. And then building partnerships to manage the numerous change efforts that are underway within our programs. Many of our proposals represent what I would term the next generation of thinking about Minnesota's system of long-term services and supports. Again, they will help consumers to have choice in where they live and where they work, promote, incent, and reward quality in the services we deliver, and ensure that we are good stewards collectively of the state's money as the demographics of the state continue to change. The most comprehensive reform in this package is the Reform 2020 initiative. The budget takes Minnesota's nation-leading long-term care system to the next level by, again, making it more consumer-driven, assisting people in need earlier, and emphasizing the quality enhancements. We have made over 70 presentations since the fall of 2011 about Reform 2020. It was a bipartisan effort to take a look at our system and promote improvements. We've held very large public hearings, webinars, community meetings. We've met with people locally as well as at the federal level to talk about these efforts. So I know we're not going to exhaust the topics here today. I speak for all of the members of the continuing care program that we're available to meet with any of you individually, collectively. We're available for community meetings to discuss Reform 2020 at your pleasure. So to try to get through the proposals, we will work in the order of the governor change pages. You have the supplemental materials in the fast facts, and certainly try to allow some time for questions. So the first element in your packet can be found on page 9, which is part of the Reform 2020 initiative, in enhancing our vulnerable adult protection system. What this proposal is attempting to do is to simplify and make the common entry point more accessible and to receive reports of abuse, neglect, exploitation of vulnerable adults through a single statewide toll-free and web-based reporting center. We have to adapt to a changing system. Most people now are not living in institutions. They're living in the community, which is their preference. And so this adapts our adult protection system to recognize that reality. We have a dispersed system where we have to rely upon families, friends, neighbors, all of us to be observant of individuals who may need adult protection. We do this in several ways. One, again, to modify our current reporting system from 87 common entry points to a single statewide effort. The work following the report, meaning who investigates, who takes that issue and then tries to determine whether some follow-up is needed, would continue to be as it is today. It would be referred to either the health department or the Department of Human Services, or the counties to do the work that they are responsible to do. So that doesn't change. This is the reporting process to make it simpler, as well as it gives us a collective database Since we're streaming all reports through a single toll-free number, we will have a complete database for all of the suspected maltreatment and abuse situations. Part of this budget activity recognizes that we need to fund that activity to the counties, the services they provide to their local citizens, to both conduct investigations, to provide other services that individuals in the community need. And so there is funding within that to accomplish that. So we think it's an improvement to our current system, which is oftentimes very confusing as to know who and how and when to report situations that may need some follow-up. The next item is the alternative care and essential community supports. This is part of the effort to ask the federal government to participate in state-funded programs for people who are not yet on medical assistance, who we are supporting in the community. We believe that these programs are very effective of keeping people off of medical assistance, keeping them in their homes. It's demonstrated success for a number of years on the alternative care side. The essential community supports have not been implemented as of yet. And that's an ongoing discussion that we're having with the federal government to participate in alternative care and help us keep people off of the more expensive medical assistance program.
Mr. Coleman, but before you go on, a number of these Reform 2020 proposals are contingent on approval of a federal waiver. And I'm just wondering when you anticipate approval, because, of course, these numbers are contingent upon that.
Mr. Chair, I'll try to address that. We have submitted on two separate occasions a waiver request to the federal government. They're now combined into one waiver document, and we've had initial conversations with CMS to begin explaining what we're trying to do to our long-term care system and our mental health system. They have not committed to a timeline, but we have informed them that of what the timeline for the legislative process is in Minnesota. They've acknowledged that. We're pushing them actively to try to get us, if not a complete decision, but at least components of a decision by March, April perhaps at the latest, so that we have the knowledge with which to have the governor and the legislature make decisions. So we're trying, but you're right. There are a lot of ifs within these proposals that will depend upon what the federal government is agreeable to allowing Minnesota to do.
Okay. And that question applies to many within the Reform 2020 package.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Moving to the next item, improving access to home and community-based services for those age 65 and older with ventilator dependency. The current system requires an individual who is ventilator dependent to go to a skilled nursing facility for 30 days in order to transition to the community with a rate sufficient to meet their needs under the elderly waiver program. It's the way things were constructed as we move to home and community-based services. We think it's an unnecessary burden on individuals to go into a nursing facility with the express intent to return to the community. So we're eliminating that step, and we're creating an exception to ventilator-dependent individuals and be able to provide a higher rate under the elderly waiver program to support them in the community. It is budget neutral because there's no additional cost to it supporting people in the community. Okay. The next item, moving to page 10, first contact, simplification, access, and transition support. This one has a number of elements to it, and I'm sure we will need to spend more time at some point in the future because it is there are a significant number of changes here. Again, under the theme of how can we improve how people access services, how people get good information with which to make choices, what we are proposing here is modifying our current processes. For example, right now, anyone who is eligible to move into a nursing facility has to go through a pre-admission screening, and that is conducted by the counties currently. We are proposing to move that to a regional-based system where we would work with our linkage lines to provide that telephonic screening, which would, again, verify that someone has gone through that process and, in fact, help them identify the needs that they demonstrate. The second screening for people with developmental disabilities and mental illness would continue to be done by the counties at that local level. So, again, this is shifting some work from what counties currently do to some other parts of the system who are very knowledgeable about services. We want counties to be able to free up enough time to be able to do the more intensive face-to-face in-person consultation that they're better able to do. Additionally, within this proposal, we have a request to the federal government to participate in our return to community model. Our return to community is an initiative that we began a couple years ago to help individuals who are in nursing facilities who wish to return to community but have not been able to do so on their own. These are primarily private paying individuals who, if they remained in the nursing facilities longer, would quickly spend down and have to participate in medical assistance. We have worked this through our area agencies on aging with community living specialists. And again, because of what we're doing in trying to address the needs of people before they exhaust their resources, it is saving the state money. It is saving the federal government money. So this is part of our request to the federal government that they participate in funding this initiative. We also want to expand this for additional targeted populations. Again, people who are either in hospitals or thinking about other services to help them remain in the community as long as possible. Also within this, we need to address how we will be paying for the comprehensive assessment, the MIN choices, which has been under development for the last 3-4 years, which will be implemented this year. And so this changes the funding stream for long-term care consultation and the assessments. The good news is that there is enough money in the system, or we believe there's enough money in the system currently to compensate counties, tribes, health plans who will be doing the MIN choice assessment. They may have a different perspective at this moment because they've not experienced it as much yet. And as they work with a new tool, they will have to get more efficient as they learn it. But we believe there's enough money in the system. So this changes the flow of money. One of the more notable aspects of this is we are taking the money out of the nursing facility rates that is currently funding this. You may have heard nursing facilities have part of their rate that pays for this. Then they have to cut a check to the county. So it's kind of a pass-through. So we're eliminating that step taking it out of that and making it a direct reimbursement to the agencies who are doing the assessment on a time study methodology. What does it actually take to complete the assessment? And our analysis is that, again, there's enough money to accomplish that task. Also within this simplification and access is a home and community-based report card. Many of you, if not all, are familiar with the nursing facility report card that Minnesota pioneered a number of years ago and has gotten quite a bit of positive comment nationally. We want to replicate that on the home community-based side. We want to measure quality. We want to deliver good information to consumers and their families about how to select their services. And so the next couple years, we would continue to develop the home community-based report card. So there's a number of elements all embedded in getting to people earlier, before they have the higher needs, through the Area Agencies on Aging and the Disability Linkage Line, as well as making it simpler to navigate. Those are some of the highlights. Okay. Home and Community-Based Services Critical Access Study and Service Development. We currently conduct a gaps analysis through our counties to take a look on a biannual basis, what are the services available out there and what are the gaps that they are seeing in helping people in their communities receive home and community-based services. We've expanded that to include not only the over 65 population, but also the under 65 population, so we can have a more complete and comprehensive analysis statewide. And again, that's a report that you will see due later on this year. But we also have a need to evaluate access. Not only are the services out there, but are people able to access the services? Are they in the right locations? Are they available? And so it's a one-time effort to really do a critical access study for all of our long-term care services. We also want to continue to build on the community service development initiative. Minnesota, a number of years ago, acknowledged that we need to build the service sector, the provider sector in the community, if we're going to transition from an institutional basis of care to home and community-based services. So we've had the good fortune of some funding for a number of years to provide some seed money, some matching money throughout the state of Minnesota. And that has built a lot of the infrastructure. Some of it has been suspended during our budget deficit years, so we've not had the full amount. But we want to expand on that because that's how we will continue the shift of services from institutional care to home and community-based care. So this... This takes all of that information, the gaps analysis, the needs determination, all of the planning work, and really then takes the seed money, the funding work, the community service development dollars to target those to services that we identify we need to build more of. I hope I haven't lost you on that. We also embedded in here are advancing the concept of Alzheimer's or dementia healthcare homes. We want to develop expertise in that structure for how to care for people with dementia. Work with the health department, work with the clinics to have that expertise. So that's also embedded in here as part of service development. The next item on the bottom of page 10 is a new service. Individual Community Living Support, ICLS. As we all know, it's very difficult for older Minnesotans to remain in their community and have to purchase services in very uncoordinated ways. Families get exhausted. The older Minnesotan gets exhausted, his or herself. What this is attempting, so what often happens is that they end up moving, leaving their home and moving to where they purchase a bundled service, an assisted living, a housing with services, something of that nature. So what this is doing is challenging the provider network to say, can you bundle these services that support people in their home and bring that to them rather than have them have to come to the assisted living? Its foundation is built upon a universal worker type concept where somebody can do multiple tasks during the course of a day. And again, the intent is to provide another choice for our older adults in our communities to be able to successfully be able to purchase a package within their own home. And we believe there are providers who will, in fact, step up and do that, who are expert in senior care. Okay, crisis diversion and discharge planning to reduce avoidable costs. We have some experience, and we've been observing in our community-based system in particular, individuals with challenging behaviors who are experiencing multiple hospital admissions, multiple emergency room visits. We believe we can do a much better job with some clinical experts out in the community, working with those individuals, working with the hospitals, working with other clinical specialists to interrupt that cycle of why people are returning to the emergency room multiple times. We have over 2,000 people in Minnesota who had four or more emergency room visits in 2012. We think we can impact that. We think the literature and the research and this effort will break that cycle. If you're looking on the budget tracking, you will not find long-term care savings. We're really trying to demonstrate that our expertise in working with people with behavioral challenges can actually save healthcare costs. And so actually the budget activity that's the savings on here is in the basic healthcare cost part of the budget, not the long-term care costs. But we still think it's a worthwhile initiative. Moving on to the next one, community first services and supports. I would suggest that this is one of the prime elements within the Reform 2020. The proposal has received a lot of work by stakeholders. It is part of our waiver application to the federal government to allow us to demonstrate this approach. And it is the next generation of thinking about our PCA, our personal care assistance program. It's a more flexible program than our current program is. For example, our current program does not allow us to pay for training an individual to do for his or herself. This program will, so that we can not build in dependencies in order to get more time, but we can actually promote more independence for an individual to receive training and skills to do for themselves. We also, in this, because of the incentives from the federal government, are able to increase the lowest number of hours or minutes that we can provide to individuals, particularly, again, for people who have behavioral challenges, the lower need but still very critical support needs, we're able to increase that from 30 minutes a day to, on average, 75 minutes a day. We also, as part of this change effort, are proposing to streamline the fiscal support or the management structure for individuals who are attempting to direct their own care, who have an interest in hiring their own caregivers, but don't want the responsibility of being the employer, the payroll, and all of the administrative functions. So we have what's called fiscal support entities, and there are several hundred of them in Minnesota. We are proposing a simplification of that process to do it more on a contractual basis, where the state would contract with a limited number of entities to do that work for those individuals who wish to direct their own hiring and services, while still assuring choice for everyone in Minnesota to have at least two or more management entities from which to select. They still would have the current agency model to select from if they don't want to get that more involved in their direction of their care. The whole program is being designed via an implementation council. It's a requirement of the Community First Service and Support Initiative from the federal government, and it is primarily made up of actual consumers, program participants, to design this program to best meet their needs. Again, it's budget neutral. We're actually able to improve the number of people who can access our lower-cost PCA program with the Community First program. So those are some of the highlights within that initiative. Again, very complex. And we're negotiating the details of that with the federal government. Empower and encourage independence. We are taking what we learned from a federal grant a couple years ago, or several years ago now, the demonstration to maintain independence and employment for, again, people with mental illness who have a job, who are at risk of losing a job, or need to find a job. We're really trying to take that learning and use navigators, use individuals who can work with those individuals to help them sustain their employment. We're targeting 18 to 26-year-olds. We're targeting those transition ages where we really want those individuals to get off to the best start possible, to understand what health care benefits are available to them, to increase their earnings without jeopardizing their health care benefits, and really take what we've learned through these efforts over the number of years. And again, we think that over time it will create more independence and save state and federal government's dollars. The next initiative is on page 12 at the top. A lot of discussion over the last couple of years about children with autism spectrum disorder. This initiative is trying to collect a lot of the research, a lot of the stakeholder meetings, and it proposes the development of a benefit set that would be focused on children of all ages, but really try to address the early intervention for children, that we would work in a multidisciplinary fashion to do a comprehensive diagnostic evaluation, working with early intervention therapists, OT, PT, speech therapy, working with schools, working with the Children's Therapeutic Services and Supports, and really investing additional funds into this really targeted diagnosis and need to get kids off to a better start to have this we have this disorder. Again, we'll need to talk more about this, but we're pleased to be able to do that.
Commissioner Coleman, I think we're going to stop there, maybe ask a few questions. I've got a couple of just announcements for members to understand where we're headed. On this particular one, though, I mean, in the on the yellow sheet, it says that there will be about 440 children eligible in the first year and then 880 in the second year, and then that's just stable from there on out is what it reads to me. Is that – am I reading that correctly?
Mr. Chair, I think we will be – I know we will be evaluating this. It will grow over time as we learn what works best and what doesn't work best. Again, this is an area of discipline where there's a where there's research going on, where everyone is searching for the better practices, evaluating how to best – intervene earliest, so we would anticipate some growth over time. That's but the ramp up is, you know, since we'd have to get this going, it's smaller in the first year, it would grow in the second year. The budget pages do reflect additional costs in the next biennium.
Not the way I read them.
Okay,
the
then I'm looking at
when in the modified. Second year it reaches 880 at a cost of $8.2 million. In the third year, it's still the same 8.2. In the fourth year, it's still the same 8.2. So, I mean, it looks to
then,
me.
Then we have.
And that's one of the things I've learned as well about this population is that you better anticipate growth. And I don't think it'll be done at the second year. But that's okay. That's just me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for pointing that out.
So.
Yeah. Senator Lurie, are you looking at this sheet? Are you looking at this one?
Sure, either one. I think either the yellow on page 17 or page 12 there, the first item on page 12 of the MMB, you'll see. You know, the first year's cost is $3.7 million. That would accommodate the 440 children. The second year's cost is $8.2 million. That would accommodate the 880. And then the cost is the same for subsequent years. And
yes.
We'd just, you know, be interested in seeing the assumptions underlying this as this progresses.
We'll talk further about that, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, and we will open it up. Before we start losing members, though, I want to let folks know once again that we will finish with continuing care tomorrow, and thank you for making yourself available again. And we will also begin hearing from other divisions of DHS next week and expect to take public testimony on the 30th, if all goes well and we continue to move. If we have to continue hearing DHS, and we will. You know, we want to have a sufficient level of detail at this so that people have a fairly decent working knowledge. But it is going to be our goal to open it up for public testimony on the whole package on the 30th. Staff will send members documents electronically, and we are planning, as has historically been the case, to try to construct a budget document. And again, anyone who's been around this place for a long time, the junkies and stuff, know the budget documents used to be three-ring binders. And personally, I loved those darn things. I can show you my old ones. They're all dog-eared and written on and arrows and Post-its. And this year's are going to be a little bit different. And we're going to work as hard as we can to construct something that's meaningful and helps members. And feel free to give us feedback on what else we could include in those books. And then also, Senator Rosen, we intended to get you a whiteboard today and put it right behind you, but we couldn't find one just yet. But we're still working on that. We're gonna have a big whiteboard. So with that, we do have a couple of minutes for initial high-level questions for Commissioner Coleman.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Senator Claussen.
Thank you. The autism spectrum, you're only – that's for young people on medical assistance only?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I believe this is part of the medical assistance program. But there's monies that have also, just to clarify, there are funds that have been inserted into the managed care contracts. This addresses the fee-for-service individuals who are not part of those contracts.
Thank you.
Senator Hayden? You're just getting wound up, and you're going to tone it down. All right. Any other questions of members?
Okay. Senator Mr. Chair, Benson. Should we leave our rulers in the folder?
Yeah, leave your rulers in the folder. You're going to need them. So, seeing no further questions for today, thank you, members, for your patience and continue to provide advice. And we stand adjourned.